something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets,
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Amy and TJ Robes. We, not too terribly long ago, we found ourselves at a wedding. And the fact that we were at a wedding ended up making headlines because we were accused of some particular behavior at that wedding. Do you remember what I'm talking about here?
Oh, yes, wedding. Yes, my good friend J.K. Long.
Yes.
Her wedding.
She got married, and it was a great wedding. We had a really good time that night. But the following day, we got messages from people, and we got some alerts, and people kind of making fun because of several headlines that were out there about our behavior. Now, when I say our behavior, we need to be more specific.
Yes, it was, we were accused of dancing a particular way on the dance floor. Mm-hmm. And yes, the dance floor was full and I was on it. But you were more notably not on the dance floor. You were just cheering me on, so to speak.
That's not what the article said. That's not what the headline said.
The article said that we were dirty dancing in front of 100 people or so on a dance floor, just showing a lot of PDA. And frankly, I guess the implication was that we were inappropriate.
Now, I don't mind the PDA. You and I, we hold hands a lot. I mean, we just naturally are that way. That's one thing, but that's not what this was suggested. It was suggested that something untoward was taking place and inappropriate on the dance floor in front of all these folks. The funniest part of that is that I have been going to weddings, of course, my whole life. There's only been one wedding in life that I did not dance at.
And that was at JK's wedding.
Did not get on the dance floor a single time. And there's a very good reason for that.
That's right. Because this was actually a themed wedding. And the theme of the wedding was Yacht Rock. And if you've listened to the podcast, you know that TJ is not a fan of Yacht Rock. Namely, because I think you have said this, I don't see how y'all dance to that.
Okay, and I think some would agree, but some of the things at least you hear me, or you play for me, I don't like them is one thing, but I find them difficult to dance to. And
correct.
One of the most famous examples is your favorite, maybe your favorite song, if not in the top three, at least, is Sailing, right?
Yes, Sailing by Christopher Cross.
Go ahead, give the people
sailing
a little bit.
Takes me away to where I'm going.
See, I'm trying to snap and sway now and can't get it. You can't dance to it. You just sway, or you're just supposed to listen, right? It's not supposed to be a dance music.
You just let your body move to the rhythm.
Yeah, that's dancing.
Yeah.
But you
I find there to be a rhythm and swaying. Okay. Swaying is moving, swaying is dancing. The point being, we were not dirty dancing. We were doing the opposite. We weren't even touching.
We actually
your feet weren't even on the dance floor.
When you hear dirty dancing, the first thing that comes to anybody's mind has to be that movie, that man. Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze, Jennifer Grey, nobody puts baby in a corner. I mean, how many times do you hear that a week? I mean, I think I said it twice already this week. There was an incident where a guy was in the corner. I'm like, nobody puts baby in a corner.
You said it last night. A guy was just trying to hold the door open for
That's
us.
That's what it was.
And he got tucked in a little bit behind the door, and you said, nobody puts baby in the corner.
I mean, it's such a great line delivered by, yes, the one and only Patrick Swayze. And I mean, I don't think even if the right music came on, babe, we could ever
do it.
We just couldn't even. I can't even imagine us ever even attempting Dirty Dancing.
Look, doing the Cupid Shuffle with you was difficult
That's
enough.
True.
So if we'll leave it there. Ah, thank you, Sydney. She gets it. but when you think about Patrick Swayze, it certainly Ghost might be. I don't know. Dirty Dancing or Ghost?
Yes.
One of the first two will come to mind. But also Roadhouse, I loved. And then Point Break might be my favorite.
Point Break.
It was a bro-y kind of a movie,
oh,
right?
Oh, it was. Oh, my goodness. I think for me, it's Ghost first and Dirty Dancing second.
Oh, wow. Okay. That makes sense. And we ended up watching a little bit of Roadhouse. We had it on because we were getting set to talk to. You know, look, he's been gone now 15, yeah. I think I have the years right, 15 years. And his wife, Lisa, who's married to for 34 years?
34 years.
Right. She has continued since his passing to carry on his legacy by making sure she fights to get funding for research of pancreatic cancer, which he lost his life after 20 months, 22 months.
22 months, I believe.
In dealing with that. But she has carried on. But she's carried on not just as a woman missing her husband, that we all know their love story, but she has her own new love story now, which makes her, I guess, in a lot of ways, for some people, they look and they want to only think about her with Patrick Swayze. But a lot of us can look at it, and I think many people do, like another chance at love, another chance at life. And just this woman who didn't have to give up anything in her relationship with Patrick Swayze to continue the life that she now leads. Lisa Niemi Swayze, but describe the dance that you were just talking about.
Oh, my goodness. I was Googling Lisa and Patrick, and I came upon this beautiful dance they did together. I believe it was in the 90s. And yes, the two of you were on stage, and obviously you're both beautiful dancers, but to see two people who love each other so beautifully dancing in that way on stage in front of everyone, I was swept away. And it looks like you're getting a little teary because I'm sure that's a beautiful memory, I'm sure. But can you take us back to that moment of being on stage with Patrick? And I mean, the two of you met dancing.
Well, yes, we did. My first dance teacher was his mom. So that's how we met. And he was my first dance partner. And I tell you what, the first time we ever danced on stage together, we did this Raimonda Pas de Deux. And you know when something clicks. And it was very classical, and he presents his hand to me, and the lights were on. It was like a high school auditorium or something. And he presents his hand, and I put my hand in his, and we looked in each other's eyes, and it was like, bang! Just this incredible magic happened. Wow. At that moment. So we pretty much stayed dance partners for the next 34 years.
You know, how much we talk about the one we just saw. We saw it on video. We saw you all in the public eye. But all of us, all couples, I mean, Roebuck and I, we do it. We dance around the house sometimes. But you all, as trained and very good dancers, did you all play around the house? And were you just dancing around in private a lot as well?
Oh, you know, of course. You know, there's some great music going on, and you kind of get in the groove, you boogie a little bit. But I tell you what, you would never dance with me out in public, because everybody would be sitting around going, what's he going to do next? As an under glass. So I was usually out on the floor by myself or dancing with the girls. So
That's funny. I just love, though, hearing about that moment you two first locked mm-hmm. eyes, and you said it was magic. People talk about love at first sight, but that sounded like what you were describing.
It was really interesting because we had a little contentious start, because each of us, he had kind of a reputation as a Casanova, I had a reputation as a bad girl, and we were supposed to stay away from each other. But it's really funny what some people know And I knew before we were done that something was going to happen between us that was significant. And I had every confidence in every bone of my body that that was what was going to happen. I didn't know it'd culminate in a very long-term marriage. But I was only like 16 at that time, so I wasn't exactly marrying myself off just yet.
Lisa, I'm looking at you here now and hearing your voice, and nothing about you necessarily would say bad girl to me. I know that was a long time ago, but did you deserve that reputation at the time?
Absolutely not.
Oh, okay.
You know, I hung around with the kind of bad, cool people because I didn't really fit in. You know how that is. So I hung around with the people who didn't fit in either. But I was underneath it all as like I was pretty conservative and cautious. But I was so quiet that nobody ever knew what was going on with me. And when somebody's that quiet, and I didn't know how to make small talk, you could see I got over that. You can kind of read into that person whatever you want to, because they're not giving you any signals.
From what you know now of what you got to know about him, did he deserve the reputation of being a Casanova?
No, he had quite a significant amount of girlfriends, and of course he was very handsome and sought after. But I think he was looking for something more than just fooling around. He wasn't a womanizer. He was very gentlemanly. In fact, I was like, he'd open the door for me, and I would kind of freak out about that. It's like, I could open my own door.
Oh, wow. So
he actually liked that. Because he was going places and going to be doing things, and he wanted somebody to come along that could do it with him. Oh. You know, not just sit and keep file their nails. But he did have come off with a bizarrely huge amount of confidence. And he held himself really upright. And he was just so all-American, handsome, talented at everything that it just kind of made you sick. And a lot of people didn't like him because of that. He was like too perfect. He's so perfect, he didn't fit in either.
Yeah, wow. You know, it's amazing because you all got married, I believe you were 19, he was 23, is that correct?
Yeah, 18, 23.
Wow. So not only did you get married young, but now you're in the spotlight. And Patrick Swayze was, as you mentioned, America's all-American, you know, just the guy every girl wanted to be with. Everyone remembers Dirty Dancing. My daughters love that movie. They love Patrick Swayze. We were just rewatching Roadhouse this morning, reminiscing. You know, it's such a part of coming up, and Patrick was such a big part of that. How? I mean, you can love someone, you can have love at first sight, but so many marriages fail that aren't in the spotlight. And to have the love story you had, was there ever a moment where it got tough or you worried about it? It sounds like you all were rock solid from start to finish, and that's just a remarkable thing. And I'm curious, how did that happen?
Well, you know, I love that term, rock solid, and I always felt that way. Mm. And, you know, things would get really tough, but we'd fight it out. We had great fights. But we always hung in there, and our fights were about hanging in there. And I think for me, when you brought up about the fame and how difficult that could be, and we're both being pulled in on so many different places, he always made me feel like I was the most important person in the world. And he would never let, like we'd be going in someplace and we'd have bodyguards, and occasionally the bodyguard would like cut me out. It's like, and he's first of all, he's just like, you don't do that to my wife. You know, Lisa, come here. Or somebody leaning over and actually had a coat put on my head once because they wanted to talk to him. And he just wasn't going to have that behavior. He insisted that everyone paid me the same respect that was given him, and always made me feel important and loved.
What was his relationship with fame? Some people I run into, they love it. Some people loathe it. Some people just tolerate it. What did he like or not like about being as big of a star and the fame and things that came with it?
Wow. I you know, that's kind of a that's kind of an interesting question for Patrick. Because he used to always say, I'm a contradiction and that's okay. And because he had contradicting sides to that, because he definitely embraced fame. He was just, from the time I knew him, he was like, I am going to be successful and you will notice me and you will pay attention. And then there's the other part of me, it's like of him that's, you know, we stayed on our little horse ranch and didn't go anyplace because we didn't want to be bothered by anybody. And so, you know, we isolated a lot, but we had our horses and our dogs and our cats and our friends. And so we didn't suffer.
Where, if he had an option, where would he prefer to be? On the ranch, you know, on the couch, hanging out somewhere, or walking a red carpet and rubbing elbows?
On our ranch in New Mexico. 100%. In fact, you know, we were both pilots and we had our own plane, so we fly back and forth. And sometimes it's like I could hardly get him to go back to L.A. He just didn't want to leave.
Wow.
Yeah. One time I said, hey, you know what? You don't have to do this anymore. We can go on a mountaintop, do carpentry. And he said, you know, but you don't have to do this pressure and everything. Because he was, at that time, he was very frustrated with some of his career choices and what he was and wasn't getting. And when I told him that, you don't have to do this anymore. Let's go do carpentry on a mountaintop. He looked at me and went, are you crazy? Yeah, we know where he stood on that one.
Okay. It sounds like both of you would have said, no matter what, the thing you were most proud of was your relationship. And just your love story is one of the biggest legacies he leaves behind. But was there something he was most proud of professionally? And you mentioned his frustrations, but I'm curious what he was most proud of and maybe what he was most frustrated by.
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, especially when he got sick, he really questioned his legacy. And he was concerned about how he would be remembered. And I have to say, he needn't worry at all. You know, he's still very much in people's minds. And for every movie that he did, there's a different thing that he liked about it and or didn't like. Well, actually, he didn't. I don't think he ever didn't like it, one of his movies. But it's just like City of Joy was very fulfilling for him. He was working with a great director and he was doing great work. And of course, Dirty Dancing, he liked to poo-poo Dirty Dancing. You know, it's like, yeah, blew the lid off my life and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, as the decades went on, and just like you mentioned, your daughters loving the movie, yeah, you know, he was still alive when he was on his third or fourth generation of fans. It's crazy. It's like super crazy. You know, these women coming up to him, grown women coming up that weren't even born when the movie came out. So that's astonishing. And, you know, he loved Ghost. Point Blank was just like an amazing ride for him. And I love it that he stands in the doorway of that airplane and says, hasta la. God, I can't believe I don't remember
it's
that.
It's adios, line. Wasn't it?
Hasta la bye-bye or whatever. He walked out.
Yeah. You mentioned he had thoughts about his the legacy. Was there more so a concern about if he'd be remembered or how he'd be remembered?
I think both. I think both. In fact, I wish I could remember, but there's a line that Tom Hanks says in whatever movie it was. I'm terrible at names today. Where they go and get the kid out of the war because the boys have died.
Saving Private Ryan.
There we go. Thank you. But he has a line that basically says what makes a man and how will he be remembered when all is said and done. And he, you know, he knew that he had achieved great fame. He also knew that, you know, at times he could be difficult. But I tell you what, most of the people around him never saw that difficult side and they absolutely adored him. And he was very generous with his time and very sweet and caring. So I don't think he needn't have worried. Yeah. I guess, you know, his whole life, you know, he was really made to do this job that he ended up doing from the time he was very young. He was trained by his mom. He was in the theater. He was a dancer. And so this is his whole life was geared towards this kind of career. And you have to take a step back and look back and go, how'd I do?
He was doing so much all the time. And 57 is far too young to leave this world and to leave this life. Did he have unfinished business? Did he have things he really wanted to do that he didn't get a chance to do?
Well, I think he would have wanted to go camping one last time. Hmm. You know, we were on our ranch in New Mexico and we were walking outside one day and it's a beautiful day. The horses were around and actually he did want to go camping. And I was like, oh my God, how am I going to do this? Because, you know, at that time he was getting a lot of medication and he was getting some pain stuff and there are bags of things. And I thought to myself, he wants to go camping. I have to find a way to do it. We're just going to go and do it. We're going to take all that SHIT with us. We have to. But anyway, we're walking along. It's a beautiful day. And he looked at me with tears in his eyes. He said, I want to live. Yeah, it was that's what he wanted to do more than anything else. He just wanted to live. It's a shame that, you know, when he first found out he had pancreatic cancer, he turned to me and he said, I'm a dead man. Because I didn't know much about pancreatic cancer, but he did. And from what he knew, anytime you heard someone that had pancreatic cancer, it was like, well, he's out of here. And sure enough, the doctor said, you know, you could go ahead and treat it and be as aggressive as you want. But do you think about getting your affairs in order sooner rather than later? That's a tough thing to hear.
He heard that immediately after the diagnosis?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. Because it had been confirmed. He had a orthoscopic, endoscopic thing that confirmed it. And he was pretty knocked out because he was in a lot of pain after that. And I couldn't tell him when he was like woozy. You know, what a thing to tell him. Hon, you got pancreatic cancer. So slept in the room with him in the hospital. And when I woke up, the doctor was sitting across from him and he was in the bed. And I knew that the doctor had just told him. So that's how he found out. Yeah.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake. someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lisa, if that's his first reaction to hearing that diagnosis, what was yours?
Mine, ugh, first thing my first action was I called my sister-in-law, who's a brilliant oncologist in Houston, Texas, Maria Skouras. And, you know, she was like, when I told her the news, she was like, oh, no. And she says, Lisa, we have to get this together. We need to find a clinical trial for him. Mm. And I don't want you to delay. I want you to have him in treatment within a week. And, you know, just to come out with all guns blazing. But your life turns on a dime. And it's just never going to be the same after that. And, just everything shifted. And we always called ourselves optimistic realists because we knew in all likelihood how this was going to turn out. But we held hope that he would be the one that would make it through because miracles do happen. And, we kept so positive about everything, but I tell you what, it was like living in a complete nightmare all 24/7.
Yeah.
And trying to keep that positive energy because, you know, I wanted to be there for him because we're going to fight this devil with everything we had. And if I sat down and cried and sobbed, which I did on occasion in private, he caught me once, because I didn't, every ounce of energy we had was going to go into helping him live. So it was a tough road.
I can't imagine. With that kind of love and that kind of commitment for one another, yes, he was going through hell physically and emotionally, but for you to be the one who has to be the rock, people don't talk about it often enough, what it's like to be the caregiver, to be the person who loves the person who's fighting and battling this. And how did you, he only caught you crying once? That blew my mind. That's remarkable. How did you do that?
Oh, gosh, you know, just... No, I find a place. I find a place to go on a crying jag. Oh, no, maybe twice. And I think the first time I cried all the way home on a drive and it scared the hell out of them. It scared them. And, but yeah, it's very tough for a caregiver when you're fighting, you know, it's going to war and it is a matter of life and death. And that those are the stakes that you are dealing with. And it's hard to take care of yourself. And that's one of the things, if I had to do it all over again, please, no.
But you know what, Lisa?
I only take this once in my life. Imagine.
Oh my God. Oh my goodness. But there are, Lisa,
it's
people.
It's not going to happen again. In fact, my husband, my wonderful husband now, I said, I'm sorry, I'm going first.
Oh, <Lisa. laughs>
I can't do this again.
Just get used to this idea. No, but coming out the other end, you know, I would recommend for people in a caregiving situation to really try have some self-care. Mm. Give yourself some breaks. I used to go to TJ Maxx and shop. Paid, you know, 2 hours, $12 t-shirt later.
One of our favorite places.
I love it. And so taking care of yourself, and I didn't do enough of that. And I, because I always said, I'll cry later. Scarlett, I'll cry later. But I can't cry now because I've got to be here for him. And, you know, after he passed, in the ensuing years after that, I really paid a high price for stuffing down all those feelings and had to go through a lot of trauma treatment that I finally got smart enough to go ahead and address so I could kind of unravel all the things that I had done to myself during all that time when I stuffed those feelings down. So, yeah, take care of yourself. You gotta be there for them. It's not going to help them if you get sick. So,
you know, Lisa, thank you for putting, both of us are sitting here wiping tears for the past several minutes and listening to you. But then you threw some humor in there. And that's something Robach here, everybody knows, she's a breast cancer survivor. She talks about this thing, cancer humor. And it only seems that it's necessary sometimes, but all survivors and their caregivers often seem to be the ones, like, almost seems wrong to laugh with you. But you clearly, we appreciated the smile. That you were able to just put on our faces just then about it. But back to the idea of the caregiver, self-care is one thing and taking care of yourself. But how important, or what do you advise people, caregivers, about letting your loved one who is battling cancer see your pain as well? It seems like you always want to keep it away from them because they're going through that cancer struggle. But is that something you certainly try to do? But is that something you advise or recommend to caregivers who are listening and people you've talked to over the years? It just seems so difficult to do.
You mean to share what you're feeling with them?
Yeah, to try to hide. You said he only saw you cry maybe once or twice.
Yeah. And I have to say, there were a couple times when the opportunity came that to have a really meaningful conversation about death and how he was feeling about that, how I was feeling about that. And it was too scary. It's too scary to address for me. And I wish, in a way, that was my weak part. You know, in a way, I wish I had been stronger to be able to risk having that conversation with him. Because it was so frightening to me that, I mean, for me, I felt like the one who was going to die. You know, he got to leave, but I had to stay here. And that was, you know, so kind of another thing. So anyway, yeah, so I think that it would have been valuable for me to have sat down and have some of those really meaningful conversations with him. Because I think he wanted it, but I think we were both kind of protecting each other in that regard.
I mean, you are, as you know, I know you're a big advocate for pancreatic cancer research, PanCAN specifically, the organization. I know you're a huge advocate and an amazing ambassador for that organization. But this is a disease that, unfortunately, so many people are still going through, walking through. So hearing what you went through and telling your story and Patrick's story, I know, as you know, helps so many people just to not feel so alone and to learn maybe what you wish you could have done. But my God, you did the best you could, because who could possibly be prepared to handle something like that? Because this happens suddenly, and unfortunately, a lot of times people pass quickly. How long was Patrick's battle from start to finish?
An amazing 22 months.
Wow.
And that was incredible, because in general, I mean, we ran into people who, like a good friend, his brother got pancreatic cancer. He had one round of chemotherapy, and after diagnosis, he was dead within 2 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
But the average, usually people pass between, because by the time you find out, it's usually advanced. Usually they pass between 3 and 6 months. And 75% die within the first year. And at the time when Patrick was ill, less than 6% survived to 5 years.
Yeah.
Now it's up to a remarkable 13%, which says we're doing something a little better now.
Yeah.
So more people are finding a way, better treatments and better ways of diagnosing all of this.
I saw that and I thought, you know, that's amazing. The numbers have almost doubled from the time Patrick was diagnosed with the 5-year survivability. But still, you're talking about nearly 90% of people after 5 years are no longer with us. That is a devastating disease and a devastating diagnosis. What do you want people to know about pancreatic cancer? What can we do? What needs to be happening? Just give us your thoughts on what needs to be done that hasn't been done yet.
Well, and I tell you what, this is why, 14, 15 years later, I'm still hanging in there, because it's not always easy talking about this stuff. Mm. You know, it brings up, you know, memories that are, you know, not all that pleasant. But I tell you what, I know what these people feel like to fight for somebody they love. And to do it with a disease that has so little resources, it's like, yeah, we all got to go at some point, but give us a fighting chance. And that's why I hang in there, because I want those people to have the opportunity that Patrick fought so valiantly for. And but the only way, of course, number one, is awareness. Well, not number one. Number one, excuse me, money.
Yep.
Funding, federal funding. At the end of April, we do our annual walk, this Purple Stride. It's April 27th. I'm going to be at Santa Monica Pier for that. In like 60 communities all over the country, we're going to be doing this walk all in one day. So it's the biggest fundraiser of the year. And I would encourage people to go to pancan.org, where they can donate or sign up to go into the walk. And but also bringing awareness so that we can know the symptoms of pancreatic cancer, because the earlier you catch it, the better. Because like I said, usually it's so advanced by the time you do, there's not a whole lot of options. And like Patrick was stage 4 when he was diagnosed.
What were his symptoms, Lisa? What were Patrick's symptoms?
He had had some persistent stomach pain. His stool had gotten pale, unusual. And it came to me one morning and it says, do my eyes look yellow? I said, yeah, they do. You know, and that's because, anyway, I don't want to get, but the pancreas cuts off the bile duct and the bilirubin doesn't get through. And so it changes, that's how that jaundice comes in. But there are other ways, like unexplained weight loss, sudden onset of diabetes. What's some of the other ones? Yeah, persistent pain in your back, your abdomen, yellowing, yeah, stuff like that. The sooner you catch it, the better. So,
you mentioned a moment ago there are so little resources. You mentioned money, but then you use that word, so little, that phrase, there's so little resources. But why is it still that it's hard to get people to rally in the huge ways we'd like to see for a cancer that's one of, if not the deadliest cancer out there, but it has the least resources and seems to get the least attention sometimes? We've had some high profile people, certainly Patrick, and certainly famously recently, Alex Trebek. But what can you say to people listening to get them to maybe think differently and start to do more of a rallying cry for pancreatic cancer?
I know when Patrick was sick, it was pretty apparent to me that everyone was, researchers are scared off this thing. Like, You know, it is so tough. And what makes it so difficult to treat is that what works for one person may not work for another, which is why this targeted therapy and molecular profiling and everything to help direct patients towards the treatment that's going to work best for them. And but that makes it a really, really hard thing to crack. It's just like Patrick, he did get in a clinical trial. I believe there were 75 people, and he was one of two that thrived on it.
Wow.
So it's very, very tough. And then these pharmaceutical companies and bio companies, you know, becomes a matter of money, because why do they want to invest all this time into developing a clinical study when in all likelihood it'll fail? Okay. And a lot of them fail. And so, but you, what you need more money.
Is that kind of it right there, Lisa? The bottom line is, who wants to invest in something that they don't think is going to be financially beneficial? I mean, that, I'm sorry, that seems like the crassest thing in the world. But is that bottom line?
Yeah, but you know what? It's going to be people like us out there that are going to be help supporting it. And PanCAN does, how many, I've just read how many millions and millions they've raised for research, and they are very keen on that. And they do a lot of research. And anytime I'm in one of their dinners or meetings, that's their first and foremost. But also PanCAN, in addition to their fundraising for research, which has been very beneficial, they also offer patient services, so that if you have a loved one or friend who is diagnosed, I would encourage them heartily to contact PanCAN.org, and you'll get a person on the phone that can help walk you through all the information that you will ever need. It's a multifaceted organization. It's like a one-stop shopping. And they can even help you find a clinical trial to get in that might be near you, and do a lot of hold handing. Because when pancreatic cancer comes up, you start learning a lot about something you never wanted to learn about. Yep.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mm-hmm. You have been and continue to be an incredible advocate, and I know that PanCAN and anyone who is battling this disease or loves someone who's battling this disease is grateful to you and to your work, because it is about the power of one voice even to get people thinking and talking and doing something different. And I know that you know Patrick is just cheering you on, because my God, like, what a legacy you are for him to be carrying this torch and to shout it from the rooftops. People need to pay attention and people need to fund research to save lives, because this is outrageous that we're still dealing with cancer in the way we are, that we don't have a cure, we don't have a way forward. And I applaud you just personally as a cancer survivor for your work and how you honor Patrick. And I think another part of this journey, you mentioned that he got to leave and you had to stay, and that's part of the pain. But I also think for anyone who's going through that or who has been through that, to look and see what you've been able to do, not only as an advocate, but personally, you did find love again. And I think that's an important part of the story, that your life didn't end. It's continued. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about finding another love? It didn't replace the love, but to be able to love again.
You know, Robert and I both feel very fortunate. And he had gone through a very heartbreaking divorce, and it was really wounded. And of course I lost Patrick, and it was about 3 years later. If we had met before then, it would have happened. But after 3 years, we were about ready. And we were introduced by longtime friends that we both known for over 30 years and who vouched for the other person. And it was, you know, I didn't realize just how lonely I was until much, much later, because I'm a buck up kind of girl, you know. I can take it, you know. This is not loneliness I'm feeling or da da da. I'm dealing with grief, yes. But it was so wonderful when it came in my life. And what was interesting to me was, you know, you think, well, how could you forget Patrick? Are you kidding me? Patrick's still with me. You know, I still have a relationship with him. It's just, he's physically not here. He's in, every day he's with me, and I feel him there. And what was really unusual was that, and I really fell in love with Albert, and it didn't affect, interesting to see how it didn't affect my love for Patrick one bit. It was like, and I was talking to a girlfriend about that and how extraordinary that was. And she says, that's because love comes from the same well. I thought that was pretty deep, a deep well. Yeah, it is just like, just because you lose a loved one doesn't mean you stop loving and you don't have that love to give. And I think Albert and I were fortunate to find someone to give that love to. Yeah.
Did you hesitate on your own even to feel like, did it take you a moment to say, is it okay for me? And talking to yourself, is it okay for me to love somebody?
Well, when he asked me to marry him, I was like, oh, shit.
No, I'm sure he appreciated that response, Lisa.
Just what he wanted to hear.
Yeah. You know, I was like, oh my gosh, well, that's different. Because I'm already married, you know. It's like I felt like I was already married, in a way. Because, you know, I still love Patrick, and I even said to Albert, I said, "Does it bother you that I still love Patrick?" He says, "No, honey. He says, I know you love him, and I know you love me, and I'm here to love you now." And it's like, oh, that's pretty nice thing to say. But I actually had a dream. When we were looking at getting married and everything, I had it was interesting. I won't go into a whole description, but it was like he was resurrected. And I was in this courtyard, and he came out. And when I see him in my dreams, he would never speak, you know, but I could understand what he was saying. And because I had many dreams about him. And he came up to me, and I'm like, and he put his arms around me, and he said, and I was like, I can't I can't marry Albert. Oh, I was elated. First of all, I was elated. Oh, he's back. He's back. He's back. And I was just so, and I went, oh my gosh, I can't marry Albert now because you're back. Thank God you're back. And he just looked at me and I, and what his words came to me were, says, no, I know you love me. He says, it has nothing to do with it. You know, he just said this, I can't remember exactly, but it was like he was letting me know it didn't change how we felt about each other and our relationship with each other. And it was like giving a blessing.
Did you need that, Lisa? Did you need a blessing of some kind before, a nod from Patrick almost before you would get married?
It sure didn't hurt.
I know that was for me almost like life imitating art, because I kept thinking of the movie Ghost when you were saying that.
Oh my gosh, yes. Oh,
it was wild. Gosh, you were describing that and I was seeing the movie in my mind.
I have to say it was a really wonderful dream, just like what I said earlier, what my girlfriend said about love being from the same well. And and going through the whole fight with pancreatic cancer and this terminal illness, and you know, it really focuses you on what's important in life, and that love, and that was the most important thing of all, was the love that we had together. So I sound like I'm quoting the end line of Ghost now, aren't I?
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Falling? I
mean, and it's so inspirational, and it's not the way anybody wants perspective to be given, but my God, it is the ultimate perspective when you realize what's important and what's not. And sadly, sometimes it comes in these types of moments.
Yeah. And interestingly, I've always, coming out of that, it's like, gosh, I never want to forget this. I never want to forget that and what's really important in life. And dang it, don't you know, you get involved with stuff and, you know, we've got a house under construction and we're renovating this and I can't get to my horses and I can't get to finish that. And you start losing track and instead of just enjoying every moment that you've got here, because, you know, we don't have each other in each other's life forever. We don't even have our own life. It's not something we own. And so we got to appreciate it while it's here.
Oh,
and that's hard. And so that's pretty, can be hard to keep track of.
Lisa, can I ask, did you ever, you all had a very public love story. And you, in your story, I'm thinking about Kelly Rizzo, who's someone we know, the wife of Bob Saget. He was a very beloved public figure, and she actually came out and made a statement not too long ago because she was getting criticism because she was dating after he passed a year and a half, 2 years or something.
Just short of 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, but she even felt that she had to come out and make a statement about how lonely she was, and to almost, she wasn't asking for permission, but I was amazed that people were criticizing her for loving again or dating again. But did you ever feel that kind of thing, even internally or externally from folks, that you all had this public love story and people only want to think about you two together, not you with somebody else?
Yeah. And you know, pretty quickly after Patrick died, I remember hearing about, Carol Joy Soitz, the author, brilliant author. And she got married 6 months after her husband died. And I was like, how in the world could you do that? You know, how in the world? And then as I went along, I went, you go, girl. Good for you. You know, and another girlfriend of mine says something wonderful. Life is too short to not, God, I'm trying to figure, I'm going to make up the first part. Life is too short to not find love, and it's too long to be alone. Mm. So, get on with it. And yes, I got a lot of flack. It's like, how dare you? And for, you know, there's some pretty rabid Patrick fans out there.
Yeah.
And who think I'm evil, you know, just don't like me because I was married to him. And so I got, there's a lot of flack that came on that, a lot of criticism. And, you know, you just learn to deal with it and move on. So, but you know, it's like, I'd like to, I was so tempted so many times to say, hey, girlfriend, stand in my shoes and tell me about it. go ahead. Tell me just because I lost my husband that I don't love him anymore. You know, it's like, how could you say that? You know, so ridiculous.
Well, I think anyone who has any worth or value in your life knows who you are and sees that and knows that you can love again, and it doesn't have anything to do with the love you had and still have for Patrick. And I love that you're speaking out about it because so many people are walking this path. And so you sharing your experience is a huge comfort, I know, to so many people. And again, thank you so much for, I mean, this is not an easy subject. It isn't. But it's an important one. And just really appreciate you lending your beautiful voice to it.
Oh, that's, thank you so much. And I love sharing about it because I know when I've heard people share their experiences, how much it's meant to me. So I appreciate the opportunity to share that.
It meant a lot to us personally. Lisa, maybe you've never listened to our podcast before, but several episodes end up becoming therapy sessions for the two of us. And I will say thank you from both of us on a very personal level, because I kid you not, on the train ride to the studio today, she and I were struggling with something. And something small, petty, but it had us kind of down in the dumps about what was going on. And we needed perspective. And we tried to get it on the way here, tried to come out of it on our own. But you were exactly who we needed to talk to today to laugh, to cry, and to get a little perspective back about life. Sometimes you need reminders. So we thank you for the therapy session today. You were very helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.